A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this prompt, and it's basically asking, when the news tells us the Israeli military high command was left in a state of confusion after that tense Netanyahu-Trump phone call, what are we actually pointing at? Like, practically speaking, how many people, what level of authority, who's in the room? Because high command gets thrown around like it's one thing, but it's not.
It's not even close to one thing. And this is the problem with almost all media coverage of military decision-making. High command is a term that can mean three people in a bunker, 50 generals in a headquarters building, or the entire senior officer corps. Those are radically different things operationally.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. It covers everything, so it means nothing.
So the prompt is essentially asking us to do a translation exercise. When a journalist writes the high command was confused, what does that map to in terms of actual ranks, actual rooms, actual decision rights?
The case that makes this urgent is that phone call. Netanyahu and Trump on June 8th, reportedly a tense conversation about whether Israel should continue retaliatory strikes against Iran. The reporting afterwards said the Israeli high command was left confused. But confused how? Confused about what? Who was confused?
That's exactly where we need to start. Because confused doesn't mean someone forgot the map coordinates. It means something very specific about the chain of command, and we can trace it through the organizational structure. So let's build that structure.
When we hear that phrase, high command, what are we actually pointing at? Let's start by mapping the territory.
The Israeli military command structure has three distinct layers, and this matters because each layer has different authority, different people, and different decision speed. Layer 1. This is the strategic layer, the kitchen cabinet. We're talking Prime Minister Netanyahu, the defense minister, the chief of staff, that's the Rav Aluf, the highest ranking officer in the IDF+, the Mossad director, and the Shin Bet head. That's 5 to 7 people. This is the group that would be directly interfacing with a phone call from the American president.
When the call happened, it's not like Trump was on speakerphone with 35 people. It's Netanyahu, probably a translator, maybe the defense minister listening in. That's the actual conversation.
And that's layer one, the political-military nexus where strategic decisions get made. But here's where it gets interesting. Those 5 to 7 people don't execute anything. They set intent. The actual operationalization happens at layer two, the General Staff Forum. In Hebrew, it's called Hamate Haklali. This is where the military machine actually translates political guidance into operational orders. We're talking approximately 20 to 25 officers, all at the rank of Aluf, that's Major General, or higher, plus the Chief of Staff who chairs it. The Deputy Chief of Staff is there, the heads of the Operations Directorate, Military Intelligence, which is Amman, the Air Force Commander, Navy Commander, Ground Forces Commander, the head of the Cyber Directorate, the Military Advocate General, the head of the Planning Directorate. These are the people who run the actual warfighting branches.
This is the group that would need to unconfuse after a confusing political call.
If Netanyahu comes back from that trunk conversation and the guidance is ambiguous, it's these 20 to 25 officers who have to figure out what to do with it. And they can't just shrug and wait. They have pilots in cockpits, ships at sea, ground forces positioned. Every minute of confusion at this level creates a cascade of operational paralysis downward.
Then there's layer three.
Layer three is what I'd call the tactical strategic bridge. These are the regional commanders, Northern Command, Central Command, Southern Command, plus the Home Front Command. That's 4 to 5 additional generals, also at the Aluf, or Tat Aluf level, who command actual troops in the field but report into the general staff. They're not in the room for the strategic deliberation, but they get the output of it, and they have to execute it.
If we're counting, what's the actual personnel number for what we probably call the Israeli High Command?
roughly 30 to 35 individuals at the rank of Tataloof, that's Brigadier General and above, who either sit on the General Staff Forum or regularly brief it. That's it, about 35 people.
35 people control a military of what? 170,000 active personnel.
170,000 active plus 465,000 reservists. So roughly 635,000 total personnel operationally controlled by a group you could fit in a medium-sized conference room.
That's a remarkably fragile bottleneck.
It's a feature, not a bug. And to understand why, it's helpful to compare with the American system, because the structural logic is similar, but the scale is different. In the US, the Joint Chiefs of Staff is 8 members, the chairman, vice chairman, and the chiefs of the 6 service branches. But the actual high command that would be involved in a decision about retaliatory strikes on Iran is much larger. You've got the 11 combatant commanders, the COCOMs, who command all forces in their geographic or functional theater. You've got the Secretary of Defense's senior staff, the National Security Council principals. When you add it all up, the American high command for a major operation is roughly 40 to 50 people.
Israel's is tighter, but the logic is the same. A small group of people who can say yes or no to a major operation, and everyone else executes.
This structure in the U.S. was deliberately created by the Goldwater-Nichols Act of 1986. Before that, the service branches operated more independently, and joint operations were a mess. Goldwater-Nichols forced joint decision-making by giving combatant commanders operational control over all service branches in their theater. It created the structure we're describing, a deliberate bottleneck of decision authority to ensure coordination.
Which, in practice, means that when a phone call happens between a president and a prime minister, the consequences of that call have to flow through this very specific sequence of people. It's not a diffuse thing.
Let me trace that flow, because this is where the confusion mechanism becomes visible. In the American system, if the president decides on a strike, he doesn't call a general directly. He calls the Secretary of Defense. The Secretary of Defense issues a formal execute order, an EXOD, which flows through the chairman of the Joint Chiefs to the relevant combatant commander. Each step has a specific person with specific authority. There's no ambiguity about who's supposed to do what, assuming the guidance is clear.
In the Israeli system?
It's more compressed, which is both a strength and a vulnerability. The Prime Minister, after that call with Trump, would convene the Security Cabinet, that's the Layer 1 group, and they'd hash out the political guidance. Then the Chief of Staff takes that guidance to the General Staff Forum and says, essentially, here's what the political leadership wants us to do. Now we need to build the operational plan. But here's the thing. The Chief of Staff in the Israeli system is not a dictator. They're first among equals. They have to build consensus among those 20 to 25 officers.
Which means, if the guidance from the political level is ambiguous, you've got 25 people who all have to agree on what it means before anything moves.
They won't agree because they're looking at it from different directorates. The head of military intelligence is reading the guidance through the lens of what Iran might do in response. The Air Force commander is reading it through the lens of target availability and air defense suppression. The legal advisor is reading it through the lens of international law and rules of engagement. Same words, completely different interpretations.
Now we're at the confusion mechanism. To understand what confusion looks like, we first need to understand who's in the room. Let's build the org chart of the Israeli high command.
We've built it. So now let's talk about what happens when the phone rings and the guidance isn't clear.
The prompt is really asking about 3 scenarios, I think, even if it doesn't name them. Scenario A is ambiguous political guidance. Scenario B is a sudden reversal of prior assumptions. Scenario C is a split within the high command itself.
Let's take them in order because they're all different failure modes. Scenario A, ambiguous guidance. This is probably what happened on June 8th. Netanyahu gets off the phone with Trump and the readout is something like, we're proceeding but with restraint. That's not a clear order. What does restraint mean? Does it mean fewer targets? Does it mean only military targets, not infrastructure? Does it mean a single wave of strikes instead of multiple waves? The general staff has to interpret intent, and different directorates will interpret it differently.
This creates operational paralysis because nobody wants to be the person who misinterpreted.
The operations directorate might prepare a full-spectrum targeting package assuming restraint means proportionate but comprehensive. The intelligence directorate might assume it means limited to specific nuclear-related sites. The legal advisor might assume it means avoiding any target that could produce civilian casualties above a certain threshold. And nobody knows who's right because the political guidance didn't specify.
The confusion isn't, we don't know where the targets are. It's, we don't know which targets the political leadership actually wants us to hit.
That's the key misconception to bust right here. When the media says high command confusion, most people imagine a situation where the military doesn't have enough information. That's almost never the problem. The military always has more intelligence than it can act on. The Israeli targeting system alone, they call it Fire Factory, Eshet Esh in Hebrew, operational since 2021, can generate over 100 targeting packages per day using AI. The data is not the bottleneck.
The bottleneck is political intent.
The confusion is never, we can't find the target. It's, we don't know if the civilian leadership wants us to pull the trigger.
Scenario B. Reversal of prior assumptions. This is where the phone call changes the calculus entirely.
This is the more dangerous scenario, and it may have been what happened here. If the Israeli general staff had spent the previous 48 hours building an operational plan based on certain assumptions, say, that the United States would provide air cover for a second strike wave, or that the U.S. would handle the diplomatic fallout at the UN, and then Trump signals on the call that those assumptions are no longer valid, the entire plan collapses. You can't just tweak it. You have to rebuild from the strategic level down.
That takes hours, not minutes.
And during those hours, you've got forces positioned, you've got pilots briefed, you've got munitions loaded. Every hour of delay increases operational risk. The enemy might detect your preparations, the weather window might close, the political moment might pass. But you can't execute until the plan is rebuilt, and you can't rebuild the plan until the political guidance is clarified.
This is the part where the 35-person bottleneck becomes a real problem. If the chief of staff has to go back to the prime minister and say, we need you to clarify what restraint means, that's another round of deliberation, another round of interpretation, another round of briefing the general staff.
The timeline on June 8th tells this story. The Netanyahu-Trump call happened around 2 in the afternoon local time. The general staff forum convened around 3:30. The reported shift in the retaliatory timeline went from within hours to within days. That's not just a delay. That's a complete operational reset, and it traces directly to the confusion at the high command level.
Contrast that with something like the Soleimani strike in 2020.
The Soleimani strike in January 2020, the U.S. high command, which was Trump, Secretary of Defense Esper, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Milley, and the CII director, was reportedly unified within 30 minutes of the decision, because the political guidance was unambiguous. The president said, take him out, and everyone in the chain of command understood exactly what that meant and what their role was. The operation flowed through the command structure without friction because there was nothing to interpret.
The difference between a 30-minute decision cycle and a multi-day delay isn't about the quality of the military. It's about the clarity of the civilian leadership.
That brings us to scenario C, the split within the high command itself. This is where the Israeli system has a unique vulnerability. In the Israeli system, the chief of staff can be overruled by the defense minister. That's not unusual. Most democracies have civilian control of the military. But Israel has an additional feature. Operational commanders can, in certain circumstances, appeal directly to the prime minister. If a regional commander or a service chief believes the chief of staff is interpreting the political guidance incorrectly, they can go around them.
Which means a confusing political signal doesn't just slow things down. It can fracture the chain of command entirely.
If different generals interpret the guidance differently, and they have different channels to the political leadership, you can end up with parallel command structures operating on contradictory assumptions. That's not confusion anymore. That's dysfunction. And it's particularly dangerous in a crisis where speed matters.
When 35 people are confused, the entire military machine slows down. Orders don't flow. Targeting packages sit on desks. Pilots wait in cockpits.
This is why high command confusion is not just a media phrase. It has real operational consequences measured in hours and lives. Every hour of delay gives the adversary time to disperse assets, harden defenses, prepare counterstrikes. Confusion at the top doesn't stay at the top. It cascades downward through every layer of the organization.
There's a historical precedent here that's hard to ignore. The 1973 Yom Kippur War.
The Concepcia Failure. This is the canonical example of what happens when the high command gets it wrong, but in a different way. In 1973, the Israeli high command, which at the time was about 20 people, even smaller than today, was not confused. They were confidently wrong. The head of military intelligence, Eli Zera, and the chief of staff, David Elazar, along with about a dozen other senior officers, had collectively convinced themselves that Egypt and Syria would not attack. They dismissed multiple warning signs, Soviet advisors leaving, troop movements, radio intercepts, because the evidence didn't fit their conceptual framework.
The difference between confusion and certainty that was existential. If they'd been confused, they might have hedged. Instead, they were certain, and that certainty nearly lost the war in the first 48 hours.
About 12 senior intelligence and military officers collectively dismissing evidence that contradicted their assumptions. The high command was a closed loop, and the loop was wrong. That's the mirror image of what we're talking about with the June 8th situation. In 1973, the problem was unwarranted certainty. In 2026, the problem is ambiguity, induced paralysis. Both are failures of the same bottleneck.
The bottleneck is both the strength and the vulnerability. It prevents unauthorized escalation. Nobody wants a colonel launching a strike because he thought he had authority. But it also means that when the bottleneck is clogged, nothing moves.
This is a design trade-off, not a bug. Every military in the world has to solve this problem. How do you maintain civilian control while enabling rapid operational decision-making? How do you ensure coordination without creating paralysis? There's no perfect answer.
Let me connect this back to something you mentioned earlier. Fire Factory, the AI targeting system.
It's been operational since 2021, and it's genuinely impressive. It can generate targeting packages using AI, analyzing satellite imagery, signals intelligence, human intelligence, and producing strike recommendations with estimated collateral damage, recommended munitions, optimal time on target. Over 100 packages a day.
Every package requires human approval.
At the brigade level or higher. So here's the tension. The AI can generate targets faster than the human command structure can approve them. You've got a system that can produce 100 strike options in a day, but the 35-person high command can only deliberate on a fraction of those in the same time period. The machine is no longer the bottleneck. The humans are.
Which raises a question we should probably sit with. As these AI systems get more capable, and they will, does the human high command become more or less of a bottleneck?
It becomes more of a bottleneck, paradoxically. Because the AI compresses the time needed for everything except the human decision, targeting used to take hours, now it takes seconds. Planning used to take days, now it takes minutes. But the political military deliberation still takes hours, because it's fundamentally a human process involving judgment, risk assessment, legal review, and consensus, building among 35 people with different perspectives.
You've accelerated everything around the bottleneck, but the bottleneck itself is unchanged.
In some ways, it's even more constrained, because the volume of options the AI produces increases the cognitive load on the decision-makers. They're not just deciding whether to strike, they're choosing among 100 AI-generated options, each with different risk profiles, different collateral damage estimates, different knock-on effect. The decision actually gets harder, not easier.
Which means the confusion problem we're talking about. Ambiguous political guidance leading to operational paralysis gets worse as the technology gets better, because the gap between what the machine can do and what the humans can decide keeps widening.
This is exactly the problem the U.S. is trying to solve with what they call Combined Joint All-Domain Command and Control, CJADC2. The idea is to flatten command hierarchies, use AI for decision support at every level, and reduce the number of human decision points. If successful, the high command of 2035 might be 5 people with AI assistance, not 50.
Which changes everything about confusion, speed, and accountability.
If you reduce the decision threshold from 35 people to 5, you eliminate a lot of the coordination friction. But you also concentrate accountability in a way that makes the system more fragile. If those 5 people are confused, there's no broader group to catch the error. And if the AI is generating the options, who's accountable when something goes wrong?
The sloth in the room would like to note that accountability and speed are inversely correlated in every system ever designed by anyone.
That's the trade-off in one sentence. Speed requires fewer decision makers. Accountability requires more. Every military command structure is a point on that spectrum.
If confusion is about ambiguous intent, not missing data, what does that mean for how we should read these news stories?
Let's pull this into actionable takeaways, because I think that's what the prompt is ultimately driving at. How do you, as a consumer of news, decode a headline about high command confusion?
First takeaway, when you read high command in the news, mentally translate it to the 30 to 50 people who can say yes or no to a major operation. Everything else is execution. If the headline says high command divided, it means a split among that specific group, not a vague sentiment among senior officers generally.
You can actually test this. If a news story about military decision-making doesn't name specific people, or at least specific roles, chief of staff, defense minister, head of operations, it's probably vague enough to be meaningless. Real command decisions happen between specific people with specific authorities.
Second takeaway. Confusion in high command is almost never about lack of information. It's about ambiguous political guidance. The military always has enough data to act. What it needs is clear intent from civilian leadership. So when you hear confusion after a phone call, what you're really hearing is the political leadership didn't provide clear direction, and the military can't manufacture that direction on its own.
This is the civilian control principle in action. The military doesn't set strategic objectives, it executes them. If the objectives are unclear, the military is structurally incapable of resolving that ambiguity. It has to go back to the civilians for clarification. That's not a failure of the military. It's the system working as designed.
Third takeaway. The size of a high command is inversely proportional to its decision speed. Israel's 35-person general staff can convene in 30 minutes. The US system, with 50-plus principals, takes 2 to 4 hours to align. That's not a bug. It's a design trade-off. Israel prioritizes speed because it faces existential threats on its borders. The US prioritizes deliberation because it operates globally, and the consequences of error are enormous.
This is visible in the architecture. The Israeli system is compressed. Layers 1, 2, and 3 are basically in the same building complex in Tel Aviv, the Kiria. The US system is distributed across the Pentagon, the combatant commands in Florida and Germany and Hawaii, the White House Situation Room. Geographic distribution creates deliberation time.
For listeners, next time you hear about a tense phone call affecting military operations, ask 3 questions. Who was on that call? Who did they brief afterward? And how long did it take for the confusion to resolve? Those 3 data points tell you more than any pundit analysis.
Because they trace the actual decision flow. The call tells you who set the political guidance. The briefing tells you who had to interpret it. The timeline tells you how much friction there was in the interpretation. If the gap between the call and the resolution is hours, the guidance was probably clear enough. If it's days, the guidance was ambiguous, and the high command had to go back for clarification, possibly multiple times.
You can watch for this pattern in real time. When a crisis is unfolding and the news reports that military action was expected within hours, but then shifts to within days, that's not just a scheduling update. That's a signal that the high command hit a decision bottleneck.
The high command is not a place, it's a decision threshold. And every military, in every conflict, is only as fast as its slowest threshold.
That's a good line to sit with. Because it reframes the whole question. We're not talking about a room full of generals. We're talking about the point in the organizational chart where political intent becomes military action. And that point is always, always a small group of people under enormous pressure, often working with ambiguous guidance, knowing that every hour of deliberation costs something.
The future of this is unsettled. If the US CJADC2 concept works, if you can flatten the command hierarchy and use AI to compress the decision cycle, you might reduce the high command from 50 people to 5. That would dramatically increase speed. But it would also concentrate risk in a way that makes the 1973 conception of failure look almost benign by comparison. 5 people, confident in their AI-generated targeting packages, with no broader group to check their assumptions.
the lo-fi girl of military command, nostalgic for a slower, more accountable era that maybe never existed.
I don't think that's quite fair. The accountability was real, even if it was imperfect. The question is whether we can preserve it while gaining the speed that AI-enabled systems promise.
We'll find out, probably sooner than we'd like.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In early medieval Patagonia, the indigenous Ayunakank people practiced a seasonal fasting ritual called Yaukken, during which adults consumed nothing but fermented guanaco milk mixed with ground caliphate berries for up to 40 days. A dietary regimen that delivered roughly 700 calories per day, which is about the same as 2.5 modern protein bars.
Oh, right. That's a lot of fermented guanaco.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, you can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. If you want to dig deeper into command structures, the Goldwater-Nichols Act is public record and fascinating reading. It's the architectural blueprint for how the American military makes decisions. Until next time.
The bottleneck abides.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.